cliffcentral.com.
The Dave Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. I did that terribly, didn't I? Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. There we go. Only took me two tries to get it right. How are you? My name is Kingsley Kipuri. As per usual, I'll be your host for the next hour. Always excited to be in studio and chatting with you. Also conversations on Twitter and on Facebook, and it's really great to engage. Never a dull moment. The Gupta leaks continue. News about strippers in prison now. Never, never, ever a dull moment. Greg Nicholson, how are you doing, sir?
I'm once again sick. I thought I had the flu once this year that I couldn't come back. But
we need to do something. We need like a partnership with Discovery for a free flu shot for you. In
Spain. I think so. Just repeatedly flu shots.
And then we just plug them. You know,
powered an IV.
Literally powered by Discovery. But thank you for coming in, despite the... I shouldn't say that, should I?
No, I don't think so.
Not for free.
No.
Sorry, everybody. I will not
if said health service provider would like to sponsor our show, you're more than welcome to get in touch with us on our Twitter, which is at DMShowZA.
There we go. An exciting show lined up. We'll be talking a bit about the Gupta leaks. Just looking back, it's been a bit over a month. Greg reminded me today. Maybe even up to 6 weeks. So we want to look back at, you know, where do we stand now with everything that sits in the public eye? Do we have the smoking gun? How does this affect the policy conference coming up? How does this affect the elections coming up? What fight backs, in quotes, are we seeing back on journalists themselves, on the narratives around radical economic transformation, around white minority capital? And where do we sit now? A bit about the process of investigative journalism, which is something that we try to spotlight. I think it's hard to trust, you know, breaking news when you're not clear where does it come from. What's the process behind this? Who stands to benefit? So we will be speaking to an amazing investigative journalist who's recently joined the Daily Maverick team to give us some of the backstory. What do you do when you have gigabytes and terabytes of data to go through and hundreds and thousands of emails? How do you sort through it? How do you release it? How do you manage a narrative that helps give people a better understanding of where we stand around democracy and our politics? Lastly, we'll speak about some regional matters. You know, Greg and I love to speak on SADC and wider continental matters. So we'll be speaking about SADC as a region and then chat a bit about some specific stories coming out of that, specifically Rwanda, Tanzania, and a bit about the Chagos Islands, which, you know, I think Greg calls the last outpost of colonialism, I think. And it's really something we like to focus on, something that really shouldn't be happening on 2017. As Greg said, you can join the conversation at DMShowZA. Now to get started, to introduce our amazing guest in studio, this is Pauli van Fyk, investigative journalist, long incredible career with The Beeld, Network 24, Mail and Guardian, and now with The Daily Maverick. Welcome to the team and to the show.
Hi, Kingsley. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we've been trying to get you on forever and just to really chat about some of the incredible work you've been doing, introduce you to our listeners and give a sense of the person behind the amazing work. Pauli, as I said before, Greg and I were just chatting and realizing that it's been a month, you know, just over a month since the hashtag Gupta leaks really started pouring out. And I'm curious just to get your big picture sense, given everything that's come out on the different parties. How do things look now from a big picture perspective? Are things fundamentally different in terms of how we understand the state capture idea from before this came out and where we are now?
Yeah, sure. Where to begin? Definitely, it was kind of a roller coaster few weeks where the one shocking revelation is made after another. I think the main point and the most important point to make here is that no one has started to sue us, or no one has initiated any legal proceedings against us, and no one has successfully and in earnest challenged the veracity of the emails and of the information that we have. So, in other words, the silence is deafening.
Yeah.
The Guptas and their cohorts are refusing to answer any of our questions. The minister seems to be on edge. Those implicated in the mails. We know that SG Gwede Mantashe has said recently that four ministers had come clean to them and talked to him and said, yeah, well, what's in the mails are actually true.
Four ministers have gone to the SG and said, hey, we've seen what's in the news and we're confirming it's the truth.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, we are implicated as stated.
Yeah.
So the second important point here is that we're still waiting for the Hawks and the enforcement authorities.
Mm.
That is something that South Africa must actually question and query until something happens. South Africa really cannot afford to come out of this unscathed or that nothing happens and nothing comes from all these revelations. We need action, we need proper investigation, and we need people to come forward and to say, I'm going to stand for what I've done and this is where we're going with this. So in terms of how we worked on it, Daily Maverick has put together a stellar team under Branka Brickic. So about an 18-person, multi-talented team. We've got IT, IT experts, financial experts, amazing investigators that working all together on this. And it's kind of like looking at a 2-million-piece puzzle without really knowing what you're seeing and what you're supposed
picture.
To build.
You don't have the picture of the reference. Yeah.
Exactly. So you don't have that picture, but you kind of know where it should go.
Mm.
And that is exactly how this email and this treasure trove is. So just to describe it for you, we have about 360,000 emails.
Yeah.
And then what's likely to be a mirror image of Ashut Chola of his computer. So he was the Sahara CEO, and in the heart of the Gupta's enterprises and how they conducted their business. So and from that came loads and loads of information of intricate deals, of intricate money flows, of how exactly the shadow economy was actually run by them and how exactly the ministers sometimes skipped going to parliament but went right to the Guptas and said, hi, this is what information we have. This is what we're going to decide. Mm. This is what we're going to debate. Going to the Guptas first and then going to the authorities and following the path that they should. And one after another, these stories are coming out, and we're working very hard to bring it out in an orderly fashion, and to evoke some change for South Africa.
And absolutely, I think the point you made, Greg, before you jump in, I think that's massive. The fact that at the end of the day, if these things weren't true, you would expect somebody to say and go to court and say, "Hey, you're telling lies about me and my enterprise," and that hasn't happened. So I think that's a really fundamental point for people who question the, you know, is this true? Which I think a lot of us were a bit worried when the flow of information came out, is what, can we trust this? That's a massive point.
So, and just why that is actually so important is once a court procedure starts, we can ask for certain things to be discovered by the Gupta side. So it's actually a liability for them.
Absolutely.
Because then we're going to say, so if you don't agree with this or if you challenge this, now come tell us the truth now. So they would be very careful not to divulge more than actually is out in the public at the moment and what we're going to put out, because there's loads more that we're still working on.
Where are we at in terms of that court procedure? Obviously, the Hawks have said that they're looking into some issues, but I think from a public... So I haven't been working on the issues at all, and I think from a lot of other news readers, it sort of seems that there's such a huge amount of allegations that could be taken forward, and sort of all sorts of crimes seem to appear to have taken place. But do you have any sort of confidence that this will be taken forward by the Hawks and the MPA?
That's such a difficult question. Obviously, I would want it, and South Africa definitely need it. I do think, however, what has transpired so far is not encouraging. What one would have wanted and expected is the day after the first allegations were made, the Minister of Police should have said, we've put together a stellar investigations team. This is where our team is going to look at. This is what they're going to investigate. This is what experience they have. And we're going to drive this and we're going to bring people to book.
Mm.
None of that has happened. We know why. Since the president has come into power, he has started to compromise all authority and enforcement entities, and investigators. And they seem to rather investigate journalists and where the leaks are coming from, rather than actually what is going on and the various kind of transgressions that will come out of this. So, but I do know for a fact that there are really good investigators at the Hawks. They are busy looking at this. And we will have to find, and when I say we, I mean this public in South Africa, we will have to find a way to strengthen their hand, either through parliament, either through public enforcement, if we can, to get them to show what they're working on, to get them to be able to bring people to book as they should.
These issues are obviously extremely political, with, you know, with ministers involved, premiers involved, very, very senior ANC leaders and deployees, you know, for example, to the big state-owned entities, a lot of money involved. And so obviously the ANC's role is extremely important in this. And unfortunately, a lot of our institutions end up playing politics. Do you know or do you have any idea within the ANC itself? You mentioned a few people have gone to the Secretary General, but within the ANC, has this caused huge sort of ructions? Are there people within the ANC who are saying, shit, this is really serious, something needs to be done about it, and we need to start within the party pushing for further action to take this sort of forward?
Yeah, definitely. So we have heard rumors of people and MPs and definitely not only MPs, like high up CEOs of state-owned enterprises going to their lawyers and making, you know, confidential affidavits telling their part. Wow. So they're definitely uneasy. But what we can see and what the public will know is that the divide in the ANC has actually grown. So we know before this came out, we knew there were at least two factions. The one would be the faction backing Cyril Ramaphosa, the deputy president. The other faction seemed to back President Jacob Zuma and his likely successor, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. So this actually just deepened the divide. So Jackson Mthembu has put Pravin Gordhan, after he was kicked out as Minister of Treasury, he's put him on a very important portfolio committee where he can actually oversee many of these things coming out now. So we've started writing about Denel. I've written about PRASA, which is not so much in the leaks, but the locomotives from Transnet side are very much also in the news and in the leaks. So Pravin is perfectly posed to question and query these things coming from the males from Parliament side. Gwede Mantashe and Cyril and Jackson Mthembu and a few other ANCs has backed the idea of a commission of inquiry. And President Jacob Zuma also seemed to, you know, to want to be seen as being amenable to such a commission of inquiry. It is, however, necessary for the public to realize that he is actually stalling it. It's not in his interest. And he would go about this like he did with his 783 charges of corruption and money laundering in the Sheikh saga. He's trying to, at the moment, to postpone it and to review all sorts of applications and court cases. But he always with that promise of saying, yeah, but I'll institute it. Don't worry. We're coming there.
Wants his day in court.
Yeah, he wants his day in court, of course.
He wants a lot of days in court.
And yet he's been his whole life trying to fight to stay out of court.
Yeah,
I'm curious about the fighting back, so to speak. As Greg and I spoke before the show, we were just curious about your view on some of the more public fighting back. So trying to defame or convolute or question the agenda of the media as a big, you know, supposedly homogenous entity, and secondly of specific journalists who are working on this.
Yeah, because the Gupta family, I guess we could start with the Gupta side.
Yeah.
With the Gupta family, they've been taking like blow after blow after blow, and it's just all these details are coming out implicating them.
That's for years now also, right?
For years as well, yeah. but then more recently, like obviously it's almost every day, with all this stuff implicating them in crimes, or, you know, what looks like serious crimes.
But now based in fact in
that's
terms
right.
of emails.
And it's often been the sort of web of corruption, I guess, which was largely suspected before, has really been confirmed. Mm. But they've been, like you were saying before, almost silent. But in what other ways have you seen them trying to fight back and to sort of either confuse the public or win people over?
So Daily Maverick did a fantastic story last week where we linked an IT kind of expert or an IT knowledgeable person to a campaign and a white monopoly capital.co.za website trying to create distrust between the public and the journalists publishing all these revelations. So Peter Bruce was a definite target. We've seen how he was surveilled, and that's actually the worst and the most horrible problematic example at the moment, where he was actually followed for what seems like days, photographed in meetings, and then some tenuous link is made with an alleged extramarital affair was alleged by this website and by, you know, what we would call paid Twitter. Paid Twitter is a thing. So, and Sam Sol, which is part of Amma Bongani and has done stellar work, has also been targeted, you know, is kind of being ousted in quotation marks as the leading face of white monopoly capital and totally in the pockets of Rupert's and Oppenheimer's. And I was accused of working for MI6, you know. So
really?
Yeah. I'm an agent for the British
That's
government.
Quite exciting. You know, very yeah. James Bond.
Yeah. With my Aston Martin and my fountain pen exploding, everything.
You have to show us them after the show, you know. We can do a little Twitter video.
Yeah. Can give you a whole tour of all my gadgets. So journalists have definitely become a target, but covertly, you know, by faceless people without actually putting their names to it, which I think is very indicative. And the fact that that person with a WMC.co.za website has been linked back as a previous employee and a far-off family member of the Guptas. The link is not tenuous, and they definitely are fighting back in a very covert and animosity way.
What about from the state side? So I actually didn't see what happened this morning, because wasn't the finance minister, Gigaba, was supposed to appear in parliament, right, to talk about the issues of him, whether he approved and why he rushed the naturalizing of certain members of the Gupta family.
Yeah.
But I didn't see. Did he appear or not?
He didn't. So the DG, the Director General of Home Affairs, and the new Minister of Home Affairs were called by parliament, and neither of the ministers appeared before parliament.
So with that, have those implicated from, and I guess we could include now certain members of, you know, sort of leaders of different SOEs and things like that, the president's son and the presidency himself, people like the Free State Premier and others. Do you see any sort of fight back campaign from them that's overt, or are they just trying to figure out how to deal with this thing right now?
Yeah, I see mostly that they mostly would want to just turn their backs on this and not really try to comment, and on definitely not on all the allegations. To speak directly about Gigaba, so the Minister of Treasury has been in the news a lot, and everything quite circumstantial about how his previous department was run, how people inside his department, for example, sent out their top secret clearance to Tony Gupta saying, "Hi, Tony, I have top secret clearance. Here it is." You know, kind of whatever you want, I can do for you. You know, with that kind of message. The big story Gigaba was involved in later was how he kind of pushed through the naturalization of the Gupta family. After it was, I think it was about 4 or 5 months after the DG of that department, of his department, declined the naturalization. So it shows that he's definitely involved. And he, at the moment, he's not agreeing to any of the allegations, denying everything and saying that he's been made a target because of his important portfolio. And when we look at Mineral Resources Minister Mosebenzi Zwani, you know, he played the race card. He said it's because he's black, or it's because white monopoly capital do not want him to go forward with a new mining charter, you know. Mm. So he's played all of these cards to try and kind of wriggle out of the very serious allegations, because with Gigaba we have circumstantial evidence saying that everything is not right there, but with Zwani, we have actual evidence of trips where he went with the Guptas to Dubai and how he helped them while he was still MEC for agriculture and tourism in the Free State, and how he grew with them up the ranks, and how he was very strangely moved to the position as Minister of Mineral Resources and helped them with their Tegeta deals and acquiring the Optimum mine. So yeah, the ministers are trying to fight back, but yeah, it's very difficult to fight back if you have, you know, these very, very clear emails and very clear proof.
You mentioned earlier the cleavages that are sort of widening between different ANC factions with these emails coming out. Obviously, this week we've got a very big political event starting on Friday, which is the ANC's policy conference. And King and I were talking before, just trying to think about how now these Gupta emails might affect the ANC's leadership race coming up in December 2015. And I'm not sure if you have a strong view on this or not, but we know that Cyril Ramaphosa is sort of basing his campaign on the idea that he's going to be cleaner, hopefully have less corruption, have perhaps a more consistent and stable economic policy. And Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, I'm not exactly sure. I think she was sort of basing her campaign more on sort of obviously ideas of radical economic transformation, trying to link in with boosting the helping the youth and sort of youth orientated strategies. Yeah. But I'm not sure what you think about this. Do you think that with everything going on right now, implicating a lot of people that actually back Dlamini Zuma, and sort of even if it doesn't implicate everybody, but sort of tarnishing that faction with the same brush, do you think her campaign has and will sort of be limited or damaged by these revelations?
Yeah, definitely. Just as a side note, she hasn't denounced the Gupta emails or what came from it or the corruption that's clearly came from it anywhere on a public stand, which is quite indicative. So what I think especially ANC voters would look for is a decisive leader, and a leader who can take the reins and get out of the mess that the ANC is in. People are very concerned about the ANC. Their loyalty to the ANC has brought them so far. But even those very loyal people would say, or are saying at the moment, to here and no further. So when we go into an election in December and Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma wins as the candidate, it's going to cost the ANC dearly. And we know that because the people at grassroots level told us so. Mm. And definitely when the Guptas are brought to book by some or other faction which is pushing for it, it would definitely assist that faction.
Pauly, I'm curious about the back end of all this. I think I'm just so intrigued by the James Bond nature of all this. But no, but
now we're building the narrative.
I know, this is now the thing. You heard it here first.
Not even close.
I'm curious about the trade-offs that go on behind the scenes. I mean, you're working on this. You're at the face of these emails, and I'm curious about the trade-offs on perhaps on one side, you know, to be factual and to present the public with the facts as soon as you can and as best as you can. And I wonder, on the other hand, perhaps is one where you're trying to build a more coherent narrative, trying to make sure everybody gets it, trying to take everyone with you. Are there trade-offs between perhaps overwhelming the public, between putting everything out at once, perhaps about competition and trying to get something out before, you know, perhaps the Sunday Times or whoever gets it? Are there these backroom trade-offs that you have to make calls on as you and part of your team, and what have those looked like?
So I think the important one part here is we publish when we're ready.
Okay.
So we're not rushing anything anymore. So what happened wasn't really the plan. Daily Maverick sat with the information and with this plan of a team and with the Gupta Mails for months. And there were certain things that we had to do correctly. So we had to help the sources to get away, and we had to help the sources to be safe.
Okay.
We had to get the information to a place where it's safe, and we also had to protect ourselves, because this information is so damning that it should bring loads of people to jail, to the jail's door. So in that process, some of the original sources, in trying to influence the NEC meeting at the time, leaked the information to Sunday Times and City Press, and they ran with the story, a big story on the Gupta leaks, and with a few summaries of you know, some of the most populist revelations.
So the big thing was, NEC meeting is coming up, we leak this now quickly, we can affect the outcome in the meeting. Got it.
Which didn't happen. And anyone who actually thought it would happen misread the politics of the day. The NEC would never have recalled the president, definitely not on the basis of a newspaper story. That we must accept and we must know. So that didn't work. So then Daily Maverick, in conjunction with Amar Bongani and News 24, started to work on these emails, and we started to write stories about it. And in the first few days, I think it was a week, we published 19 stories. And we realized this is not
going... That's a lot.
It is a lot. And we worked like hell. So around the clock. And we realized, okay, so things didn't work out as we planned. We wanted it to be very orderly and very thought through. It's not working, but we've now sort of plucked the low hanging fruit. Now really is the puzzle building, you know, where you think of 3 years back worth of tip-offs, and you see this email and you see that financial statement and you go back to sources. So this is where the real verification comes in of what you actually see, and you really, this is to go back to that 2 million puzzle that you're building. This is really where the difficult work starts and where the real investigative work starts. So we're busy with that, and we have a few stories in the pipeline, and it's managed by the editors, of course, of Daily Maverick and Amar Bongani and News 24. And so at least once a day or twice a day or so, we release a very hard-hitting story about the Guptas, but very well thought through, thoroughly tested, and nothing rushed.
Cool. Are you ever worried about your personal safety? That somebody's going to... I mean, your name's in the public, you know, fairly big profile, and people know you're working on this. Are you ever worried that you find yourself either on a website, on WMC, or that people are following you or anything like that?
No, we actually are not. We were, and I think it would have been problematic if we still sat with all of this and it hadn't gone out.
Okay.
Then there would have been an incentive to hurt us. So at the moment, fortunately for us, the fight back campaign of the so-called WMC.co.za is so sloppy and so badly done that everyone can see right through it.
Yeah.
So we're okay at the moment, and I think we know that we've touched a nerve, and it actually just fires you up.
Sorry.
Right. No, but now we're actually running out of time with you, so I think he's squeezing it now on last trick question.
Okay. I'm glad that you mentioned that the initial leak, with the aim was to force the hand of the NEC meeting, and that brings me to think about just agendas, and these are beautiful words that we throw around all the time about agendas and media agendas. I'm curious if there's any concern on your part about doing the right work, but in a way that aligns with somebody else's plan. So, and this is completely speculated, but it's things that people say when they debate, you know, things that are happening in the news and in politics.
Definitely.
So in theory, the media is doing the work, and Daily Maverick and Scorpio are doing the work. It is true and it is good journalism. However, the leak is an attempt to focus all corruption narrative around the Guptas, and therefore we excuse the banks, and therefore we excuse all the apartheid era corruption and so on. Is there ever concern for you that the work is being done truly and correctly and justly, however it's part of a bigger agenda that perhaps is more sinister?
That is such a good question and an important one. But the short answer is no, we're not, definitely not worried, because so strangely, the Gupta's alleged corruption, or that what the wrongdoing that it shows, is so all-encompassing that it really touches on every sector of the country. The so-called white monopoly capital that they so denounce, you know, they've worked with them a lot. The banks haven't. We're working on stories about the banks, about their auditors. So we are definitely not letting slip all sectors of the people and the public and the government who has worked with the Guptas on this. So we're definitely not worried about only targeting the Guptas.
I was really hoping to get into some of the work you've done on Prasa, because you've been in the midst of all these Gupta leaks. You've been doing some fantastic stuff on Prasa with both the story on Arthur Fraser, our new crime intelligence boss, linked to sort of dodgy deals there, as well as Sifiso Buthelezi, the Deputy Minister of Finance, and just in general the fact that I think the recent investigation found that 13 out of 216 contracts awarded between 2012 and 2015 with values over 10 million rand, only 13 of those 216 were above board, which is just insane. So I think we'll perhaps like to get you back to talk about that soon.
Is that like 5% or something?
If
that's just a mess.
It's insane. It's like, is it 2 or 3%?
Yeah, that's a mess.
We're journalists. Our maths isn't the best. But, but seeing this is the first time we've had you on the show, I want to ask you, You've described how hard you've had to work recently, some of the slander that's sort of come your way. You know, this isn't always the most rewarding industry for what you sort of put in. So why, and you could, I'm sure you could get a job in PR or government or any, you know, all sorts of different fields. Why do you do this? Why are you an investigative journalist? Why do you want to be a journalist and continue to be a journalist?
I think all journalists, and especially the investigative journalists, are kind of have a whipcracker mentality, you know. So we get a kick out of it, of pulling back, reining in power, and especially unchecked power. And we have a deep love and a deep loyalty for our country. We are South Africans through and through. And we want to see things go well for all our people. And when things are not going well, you start asking why. And especially in a country like ours, where we come from a very problematic place and a very problematic history. And we knew where we had so much hope for a new establishment. And when that doesn't happen, you have to ask why. And you have to have people that is asking why. And you have to have people that tells government, but you're not living up to your promises. You're not living up to what you said you would do and where you said you would be at the moment. And journalists, I think, well, me personally, we're just driven by a deep love for what we do. And also you have that investigative mentality. So it's quite nice to pull different strands together and build this big puzzle. So that, and it's not an easy job, as you guys know exactly. So but it's very rewarding. And in terms of when we say it's rewarding, you don't only think about the financials of the matter.
Absolutely. Holly, thank you so much. Not only
thank you for having me,
for chatting to us, but for the important work you're doing. We look forward to having you on many times into the future, and you know, we're glued to our phones every morning to see what the next piece of the 2 million piece puzzle is. So thanks for the important work, and keep it up.
Thank you so much, King.
All right. This is a Daily Maverick show on cliffcentral.com. That's investigative journalist Pauly van Wyk. We're going to go into a very quick break, and then we'll be right back.
The Daily Maverick show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com, going to the second portion of our show, where, as you know, we love to do, going to talk a bit about things continental. For this, we'll be speaking to Kirsten van Skeer, who's an award-winning journalist, who's now being published on DM's pages. You may know her from Sadek Rap, which is a sort of phenomenal newsletter that goes out to give you a roundup of some of the news coming out of the region. She's done some excellent work with the MNG, with the AFP, with the Star, and now with the Daily Maverick, of course. On the line from Cape Town, we have Kristen on the line. Kristen, can you hear us?
I can hear you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've been trying to have you on for ages, so I'm glad that the day has finally come. Kristen, you've done a lot of things. You've worked in environmental journalism, won some awards. And I'm curious about, you know, how this all came together and how we now know you for SADCRAP and you now doing the work you do around the region and the continent.
Well, I've always wanted to cover the continent. It's always been my goal to report internationally as much as I am an avid follower of local news. And so it was around 2014 I started a small blog called The SADCRAP. And the purpose really was to get me a job in international news. It was the idea that if I was to get called into an interview with an international editor, I would know the region. I would know the region backwards. I'd know the politics. I'd know the players. And then people just started sort of signing up for it. And then I did a stint with the French news agency, AFP, for 2 years in Johannesburg. Now freelance, still looking at the region. And gladly, Daily Maverick has picked up the SADCRAP as a weekly column.
No, it's phenomenal. Highly recommend it to everyone listening, and I will tweet a link to how you can, you know, find it on Daily Maverick or subscribe directly to get it. And it just makes me look clever. Every time I'm at a dinner party, I'm like, you wouldn't believe what happened in Angola yesterday, and I sound like a genius. Actually, I'd love to jump into some of the news stories.
Let's do it.
Embarrassingly, this is a country that's not part of SADC, so probably not a great start. But I'd love to start with some of the news coming out of Rwanda, which sounds really crazy. So I'd just love to start from really basics. Who is Kayumba Nyamwasa and what on earth is going on?
Kayumba Nyamwasa was the former right-hand man of president of Rwanda. And he, like many of the top players in Rwanda's ruling party, their hands are not clean after the 1994 genocide. Mm. There was dirt committed on both sides. And President Kagame and several of the top officials have for years faced allegations regarding human rights abuses, regarding genocide, and regarding shooting down the plane of Burundi's president in 1994 that set off the 1994 genocide. Mm. Now, after a falling out in the early 2000s, Nyamwasa fled to South Africa, first to Uganda, then to South Africa, and he's been here ever since. 2010, there were two attempts on his life, and there's been another one since then as well. Basically what's happened recently in terms of his case is he, after all these attempts on his life, has finally reached a point where the courts have recommended that South Africa needs to consider whether a person facing allegations of genocide and human rights abuses should have refugee status in spite of those attempts on his life. Mm. So now he's looking at a situation where he may actually have to face courts in Europe for these allegations. And that kind of opens up a whole bag of worms regarding President Kagame himself, because if Nyamwasa testifies in these cases, who knows what he'll say about President Kagame.
I mean, that makes sense, because I'm thinking both in the Rwandan Patriotic Front, anything this person was very close to Paul Kagame done, surely we can assume implication of the president himself.
Absolutely. And there are two different trials going on at the moment, or investigations at least, one by the Spanish, which is looking more into human rights abuses that were committed leading up to the genocide and then after the genocide. And then there's a French investigation which is specifically looking into that plane being shot down that sparked the genocide. Now, in the Spanish investigation, Kagame, the legal investigators, that they recognize that Kagame has immunity. He's a sitting head of state, so there he's more or less safe. But on the French side, there was a report that came out last year from a brilliant Canadian investigative journalist, Judy Reaver, where she got documents that showed that Nyamwasa has approached the French team to say, listen, I can testify against Kagame. I can give you proof that he was the one who ordered for this plane to be shot down that sparked everything. So it's really very interesting, and it's one of the reasons why people speculate that there have been these attempts on his life. It's just a matter of fact that former allies of Kagame who have since fled the country have been taken out. There have been attempts on their life, some of them successful.
I mean, that's the next thing I was going to ask, given that it sounds like it's in President Kagame's best interest for this to go away. And given that we found his former, colleagues or right-hand men, dead in hotel rooms in Sandton, Johannesburg, can we assume that Nyamwasa is in very serious trouble on that front?
That would certainly be his contention, and I don't think that it's a false one. For all the bad things that he's been accused of and the allegations he's facing, I don't think that that means that he is out of danger. I don't think that we should go, oh, this guy's facing genocide charges, therefore let's not take seriously the genuine threat to his life, because people have been murdered. His closest friend, Patrick Karegeya, also a very close ally of Kagame, like you said, found dead in a Sandton hotel room. It's a real problem. There is no way for Nyamwasa to be extradited back to Rwanda. He's already been tried in absentia there for other crimes. He would go straight to prison. It's not safe for him to go there. It's not safe for him to go to Europe because he'll get tried. There's a very small world available to him that is safe to be in. And even South Africa is not proven fully safe in that regard.
Absolutely. I know we need to move on to other stories, but two quick questions on this before we move on. I'm curious as to, you know, South Africa's stance on this. I imagine after the whole Omar al-Bashir debacle, South Africa would really love to just not have anything to do with presidents and regional politics and who's who, but somehow we still end up in the middle of these matters. What's our stance on this? Could you see us aligning with Kagame and saying, hey, we'll do what you want? Are we more likely to go with the French and the Spanish and say, feel free? Are we just trying to stay out of this as much as possible and just be quiet and see what happens?
Well, South Africa's stance for the longest time was to stay out of things. Yeah. You know, quiet diplomacy, keep out of it. Let the countries handle this between themselves. And then in recent years, we've seen that turn into an active antagonism against the ICC, for example, against Western powers seeking justice against African powers. And there are valid critiques that support that position. But I don't see South Africa siding with Rwanda in this instance, simply because it would legitimately be putting a man's life at risk. Interestingly enough, South Africa fought this application to have Nyamwasa's refugee status rescinded all the way through the courts for years. They have not responded to any of the requests from the European investigations to have him extradited or to cooperate and to help send information, nothing. And then last month, when the case got to Supreme Court of Appeals, they suddenly, in an out-of-court agreement, just conceded, we're not going to win this one. And that's quite interesting. Because that's a complete shift. But at the same time, just days later, you had the ANC in a press conference making it very clear they are not changing their stance on the ICC. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. Maybe just legally they saw the writing on the wall in Nyamwasa's case. But as a party, at least, the ANC is still adamantly against Western prosecution of African powers.
Absolutely. We have Rwandan elections coming up in August. Paul Kagame going for a third term. So, Kristen, I'm sure we'll come to you in the build-up to that. I want to switch to somebody that's actually in Chagos. Jesus Christ, in SADC, Tanzania. We've seen the president go and declare a ban on pregnant girls and teenage mothers in schools. And the quotes are just really indefensible. As long as I'm president, no pregnant student will be allowed to return in school. We cannot allow this immoral behavior to permeate our primary and secondary schools. Why on earth, what's in it for him? Why is this helpful for a president to go out and declare this? I mean, you don't really, as a president, have to talk about details like this about, you know, primary education. Why is this happening?
This is something that's actually been around for a while, and it was the kind of story that when I saw it, I felt uneasy about, simply because I really hate it when the international media picks up on a little sentence that's said here or there and then use it as ammunition to sort of like roll their eyes at Africa. They did that a couple months ago with Zimbabwe when an official said that villagers could use goats to help pay for school fees, which, you know, when you examined it, was actually a very practical suggestion in a country facing a cash crisis.
That's a pretty good idea, yeah.
So when it came to this, I was really, when I saw, you know, that so many international media picked up on the story, I was really hoping that this was a misinterpretation of something that was said, that there was actually something practical behind it. But it really is just indefensible. It's been going on for years now, where opposition MPs have been trying to get the government to reconsider their stance on this. But essentially, what is happening is that there are officials going into schools and conducting pregnancy tests on a monthly basis. And if a girl is found to be pregnant, she is expelled and she is not allowed to come back. There's no having the baby and then coming back to school. The girls are kicked out. it's something that I don't quite understand what the president gets out of this. But what we have seen with Magufuli's presidency is some dangerous authoritarian and moralistic stances that he's been taking. He's done well in terms of really clamping down on corruption. But we've also seen, in addition to this, sort of charge on women's education, is in the last 2 years, a sudden and worrying fight against LGBT rights in the country, something that, though illegal, has, well, sodomy is illegal in Tanzania, not homosexuality, but it's always sort of been tolerated until last year when you had people being arrested, you had names being published, and that is strange and that is worrying. And again, it just reminds me of this nuance with which we have to look at the continent, that somebody can simultaneously be good and bad for their country, that they can fight corruption and at the same time take the women's movement and the LGBTI rights movement backwards years.
I mean, I hear you, and I've been wanting to speak about Magufuli on the show for a while, because once he first took office, he had some really bold, I think Greg calls him the bulldozer, some really bold moves of coming in and saying corruption this and firing people, and some really public gestures of no nonsense, new era for Tanzania. And those things are exciting for the public and so on, and they're big signals that things are changing. But I always worry about people so comfortable to take decisions independently without consultation, because the second that turns, we see the other side of that, right? We see the impact when it's now against the LGBTI community, or when it's on girls in schools. It's just this idea of, I know what's best. I don't have to consult or do it in line with the laws or whatever. I can just go out and make a claim. So are you worried, or is that just me? Are you worried about a slippery slope of authoritarianism from somebody who really started as a really welcome fresh air for Tanzania?
I am worried. I'm worried whenever leaders impose their own morals and their own worldviews on the people. There is nothing about good governance in these two specific spheres, against women's education and against LGBTI rights. Nothing about that improves the country. It is just somebody imposing their morals on a community. And it's what you see happening in so much of the world when a conservative person comes to power, and people latch onto it because they have those same morals that they've been holding back and maybe not saying out loud. And now you have a person in power saying it. And I mean, it's a real threat to people's lives. You cannot say that it's okay for Magufuli to be doing what he's doing, when it literally holds so many girls back. They will never get that education back. When it legitimately puts people's lives at risk for the LGBTI community, I mean, that is deeply concerning.
It's completely in contrast with what he was saying earlier, and the hopes we had for him when he came in. But Kristen, just before we let you go, we want to touch on one last issue. Chagos Islands. I think our listeners, we've focused a little bit on the show before, and our listeners will know that the population there were removed and sort of exiled from their homelands in the late 60s, early 70s, largely to make way for a United States, I think it was it Navy or Air Force base military base on the island of Diego Garcia. And now, just recently, the United Nations has ruled against Britain in a vote on this issue, and they're sending the matter to the International Court of Justice, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
can you just take us through the potential impacts of what might happen there at The Hague?
So this is interesting. It's what has been passed by the UN General Assembly is a referral of this question around the legality of the decolonization of Mauritius, about the secession of Chagos by the UK, to the ICJ. Now, what the court will do is they will give a legal opinion. Mm-hmm. It is not binding, and it will take about a year and a half still, so this is not something that's going to happen quickly. And at the end of that,
considering the 50 years it's taken so far, that's actually not too not too slow.
It's not too slow. But whatever it is they say, if in the end they go, the way that Mauritius was decolonized, the separation of Chagos from Mauritius just before we granted them independence, that was not legal. There's nothing in that opinion that will force the UK to do anything after that. It's just an opinion. Now, I've spoken to a couple of lawyers, and I'm working on a story on this for Daily Maverick this week. What lawyers are hoping is that because the UK has this reputation as a law-abiding country, it sticks to its international commitments, that it will have to act to maintain its credibility. And the decisions that it makes based on that legal opinion, if that opinion goes Mauritius' way, will go a long way in determining what kind of country the UK now sees itself as in this increasingly isolated position it's created for itself in the world.
Interestingly, I noticed that I think it was all most European countries and EU members decided to abstain from this vote. Is this one sort of effect and sort of a sort of whip back from Britain's decision to pursue a Brexit?
I think it's absolutely connected to that. You know, in the statement that the different European states made explaining their votes, they all said that they agreed with the United Kingdom in principle, that this was a bilateral issue, that it should not get referred to the court, that it should just stay between the UK and Mauritius and they should talk it out. But the UK specifically asked, if that is your position, don't abstain, vote against the motion. And those countries abstained. There were only two European countries that voted in favor of the UK's position. And that says something very, very big. It gives a signal, first of all, to the courts that, you know, there's a kind of a hands-off approach. If you decide that this is not legal, what happened, we're not going to mess around. We'll take your opinion and as is. When you consider that big countries like China, like Russia, they abstained from voting. They didn't take a stance on it. That's a sign to the court that they're okay with them handling the matter. And I think that it's a real sign that the UK finds itself losing its credibility on the international stage.
I think looking at the story of the Chagos Islands and considering what happened and how long it's taken for the population to find sort of any sort of semblance of justice, has this UN decision, how has it been received in the UK, and is there any sort of building sympathy for this cause that has sort of for a long time, I think a lot of English and Britons have really resisted and really been reluctant to engage in sort of the horrors of their colonial history. Has this changed anything?
I can't speak really for the reaction in the UK. I know that the statement that I got from the UK embassy was one expressing deep disappointment at the result, that they really did not feel that this was the correct route to handle the matter. And on the other hand, I spoke with the Mauritian ambassador, and such joy over what happened. I mean, this isn't just a story about the UK's losing authority on the international stage when it comes to this matter. It's a real story of African unity. You know, this motion was pushed through by the African bloc at the UN. They voted utterly unanimously from north to south, east to west. Everybody was behind this motion. I think what is obvious to a lot of the African states is that this is a matter of decolonialization, whereas the UK sees it as a sovereignty issue. You agreed to give us this piece of land in 1965. It is now our land. We didn't colonize the land. You gave us the land. So there's a fundamental misunderstanding between the two sides of how to see this. But you can see from the voting patterns, former colonies really got this is a colonial issue.
Yeah. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
For the excellent work, and I'm sure we'll have you on many more times in the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks, bye.
Fantastic. If you're just tuning in, that was Kristen van Skeer, who's now writing for Daily Mavericks pages. Remember to just keep an eye out for her work. We'll tweet a link to Sada Crap, the great newsletter we spoke about before. I think a fun opportunity over this hour to introduce you to some of the sort of the newer people we're working with, give you an idea of what they're working on, some of the personalities and faces behind the work. So thank you for tuning in. Thanks for tweeting and listening as always. Remember to download and share the podcast far and wide. A big thank you to everybody who joined us, and of course to Greg Nicholson for helping put everything together. We'll see you next week, same time, same place. CliffCentral.com.